15th. Yeah. It's now the 15th of September, and I'm continuing the interview with Roger Martindale. Roger, when we finished the last session on personal protection, what it entailed, etc., and we covered some of the overseas visits you've done with the Prime Minister, including the visit to Gandhi's funeral, and also a visit to United States, which involved playing of golf, among other things.
Yes, that's right. In fact, I did, I think, 23 overseas visits with the with Hawke. And because, of course, we are so far removed from the rest of the world that when you did go overseas, often you did three, four, maybe five countries in the one trip, which made a pretty long tour for me, because although his itinerary might only be 2 days in each place, I always went beforehand, so to do advanced stuff and travelling commercially to do that obviously took a long time. So quite often I would leave at least 2 weeks before the official party left, and then I would end up in the place where they started the visit and then do it all again with them, having got to know everybody and all that. So it was incredibly interesting. But I'd say, yes, I think I did 23 overseas tours. He did more than that. I didn't do everyone with him, but I did the majority. We were talking about, I think, a trip to the US. We would always go to Washington, of course, and meet with the president, and then to other places as well. One occasion, which included a golfing trip, Hawke was a great friend with George Shultz, who was the Secretary of State in the first Bush administration, I think. He lived at Stanford University, on the campus at his house at Stanford University, and they'd been friends for many, many years. Shultz invited Hawke to play golf at one of the very famous golf courses on the Monterey Peninsula. And I can't remember which one it was, but it's one of those famous ones. There's about three or four there, I think. And it sort of caused an internal incident in the United States. In the US, the United States Secret Service at that stage were responsible for visiting heads of state, so they were responsible for the security of the Australian Prime Minister. The US State Department were responsible for the security of the Secretary, but they were also responsible for the security of the spouses of visiting heads of state, which meant a division in responsibilities. Now, in practical terms, when the Prime Minister and his wife were together, the Secret Service used to do it and include both under the umbrella. But if the Prime Minister's wife did something separately, then it wasn't the responsibility of the Secret Service, and the State Department had to do it. But anyway, we were leaving in the following. We played golf at the Shultz's home golf course in San Francisco, and the following morning Shultz's plane was leaving with him, and he invited Hawke and his entourage to fly down to Monterey on his plane to play golf down on the peninsula. That evening Hawke had dinner at Shultz's residence. The Hawks had dinner, and the Secret Service were there with us, and the State Department security were there because of Shultz being there. And I could sense all evening a tension between the two. And I don't think that was unusual in those days, but there was this growing tension, which resulted late in the evening, before we left, in the Secret Service agent coming to me and said, when we arrive at the Monterey Airport, I want you to make sure that your Prime Minister comes in our car, the Secret Service car. I said, where's Mr. Shultz travelling? He said, oh, he'll be travelling in his own motorcade. So I said, well, I'm quite sure that my Prime Minister and Mr. Schultz, having been friends for a long time, were travelling the same car together. He said, well, no, we can't have that. And it became apparent that this tension between in the evening had been between who was going to win over who travelled in which motorcade. And in fact, I found out subsequently that they'd been referred back to Washington and during the night and all things. So it hadn't been resolved in the morning, so we went out to the airport, drove in Schultz's plane, and I told the Secret Service agent that the Prime Minister would travel with Schultz, and that was it. I'd already briefed the Prime Minister on that. As we were circling Monterey Airport, which is a fairly small airport, I could see two Secret Service-type motorcades lined up beside the tarmac, one Secret Service, one State Department. I told the Prime Minister when he got off the plane, the Secret Service man would ask him to get in his car, and he said, well, no, I'm not going to do that. So I said, yeah, I've told him that, he'll still ask you. So anyway, he got off the plane, the Secret Service bloke said, Prime Minister, will you come this way? And he said, no, I'm going with Mr. Schultz. So, and there were signals between the two, and it was just amazing. The Prime Minister and George Schultz got in one car. The two ladies, Mrs. Hawke and Mrs. Schultz, got in the car behind, or the next car back behind the security car. And there was obviously some glee amongst the winners and various hand signs made. But anyway, what happened was the two motorcades merged into one as we left the airport down through these winding roads down through to the Monterey, down to these golf courses, which might have been a half an hour's drive. And to take two VIPs to play golf, I think I counted at least 32 vehicles in the motorcade. It was just extraordinary. However, since then they have overcome this and changed their legislation. And I'd like to think it was because of, you know, our incident down there, but it was certainly very tense between the two organisations at the time. And we were stuck right in the middle of it.
That reminds me, there was, of course, President Bush came and visited here while Bob Hawke was Prime Minister. And were you involved in security at that time? And what was the comparison between the kind of security that was...
George Bush Senior came at Hawke's invitation, but a few weeks after Hawke had been deposed by Keating, which made life again very interesting. So Keating, in fact, hosted Bush, and Hawke was one of the guests. In fact, for that visit, because I had already left Hawke by then, for that visit I was the head of security for the Australian head of security for Bush's visit. So, you know, I mean, I had a big involvement in his visit to Australia. But yes, I mean, it was because Hawke and Bush got on very well, and it was, you know, quite sad for Hawke not to be able to host, having done all the groundwork. And it was literally only weeks after Keating had been taken over as Prime Minister. Yeah, so, you know, there's lots of diplomatic incidents or potential diplomatic incidents out there that you have to cope with.
When you said when you go overseas, travelled overseas with the Prime Minister, was it just you? Did you have...
No. In advance, it would be me and one person from the Attorney General's Department who was more of a policy person. But nobody from the Prime Minister's office went in those days. So apart from doing a security advance, which was my main objective, I used to do a lot of other protocol type stuff as well. On behalf of the office, I used to do things on behalf of the office whilst I was away. So... certainly I was, you know, I mean, I was the sort of the lead person in terms of organising the visit together with our local missions overseas.
Any other visits that stand out in your time?
Oh,
places or people?
Yeah, I did, including the Gandhi thing, I think I did three or four visits to India. The first one, and I think it was Hawke's first overseas trip in 1983, was the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in New Delhi in 1983, late in 1983. That was also interesting in terms of the accommodation. I think that a point was being made to everybody that we were in then, you know, a reasonably poor country. I mean, it's changed a lot since then. But there was a government-owned hotel called the Ashok Hotel, and I can tell you it was a shock. It's where all the they insisted all the heads of government stayed in this one hotel, and we got there, and the suites that had been prepared for the heads of government had all been repainted and were terrific. However, the rest of the place was in a fairly dilapidated state, and I can remember arriving and going into my room, and Mrs. Hawke's secretary was in the room next to me, and she went in, and not long after she'd gone in, I heard this shriek, and went running around, and she had, you know, they had just got off the plane. I'd been there to meet them. They got off the plane. She'd gone in, obviously gone into the bathroom, went to flush the toilet, and the cistern had fallen in part, had fallen in two, and the whole place was covered in water. So that was a good start. It rained heavily at one stage there, and the water was coming through the ceiling lights where the ceiling lights were, and it was just unbelievable. It was the John Bowen, a fellow called John Bowen, was Hawke's international advisor at that stage, and he was a very funny man, and he went to his room, which was on the third floor. We were all on the third floor apart from the Prime Minister, who was on another floor with security on that floor and everything. Bowen went to his room on the third floor and refused to stay there, and went up to the Prime Minister's suite, who had an anteroom, and said to the Prime Minister and Mrs. Hawke, "Look, you know, I've no way in the world I'm going to stay in my room. Is it all right if I sleep on your couch?" So they said, "Yes, it's fine." So anyway, the working in this hotel was quite difficult. There were only two lifts, and when you were going out in the morning, everybody was going at the same time, and there'd be heads of government in lifts and staff. And anyway, one morning, and Bowen, John Bowen, had been was a fairly well-known diplomat before he went into, you know, before he became the Prime Minister's international advisor. So he'd, you know, been around the world and was well-known. Anyway, one morning, I was going down early to make sure the cars were there, and Bowen was with me, also wanting to get into the lift, and the lift went up and down about seven times before we could force our way into it. And we forced our way in, and there was an African leader there, in his robes, looking magnificent. I had no idea who he was, but Bowen obviously did, but Bowen hadn't noticed him because he was sounding off about this hotel and his room on the third floor, where this African leader, in the middle of the seventh floor trip in the lift, said, announced in a very deep voice, "Mr. Bowen, you seem to be having trouble coming to terms with the third world." And Bowen immediately replied, "The third world, I have no trouble with the third world. It's the third floor of this hotel I have trouble with," which then cracked up the whole lift. So yeah, we had some funny moments, I must say. I think really it was because of Hawke. He surrounded himself with characters, and to be quite honest with you, I've been thinking about it. I think that's one of the differences between working in the old Parliament House and the new Parliament House. It seemed to me the old Parliament House was full of characters, and I don't know, it's because you saw these people more often and that. But, you know, the moving into the new house, people were, you know, detached from each other, and you know, there doesn't seem to be the characters there that there used to be in the old days. But I guess that's the same in certainly the same in the public service, I think. Certainly the same in the police force. There were lots of characters in the police force when I was a young policeman that you couldn't get away with what they used to get away with now. Makes for a very much poorer world, I think.
Do you have any, from your work point of view, do you have any security scares or anything on any of your visits?
Oh, no, none that really stand out. We, you know, we were in places that things could have gone nasty. I mean, I can remember a trip to Islamabad in Pakistan where, you know, I mean, times weren't times there and problems weren't that very far removed from us, and it was a place where you could turn into violent demonstrations at very short notice. So, but no, we were pretty lucky, and of course, you know, host governments go out of their way to make sure that their visitors aren't embarrassed by things. So, you know, security was generally pretty tight.
So, from your perspective, these overseas visits were relatively easy to manage from your work point of view.
Yeah, from a work point of view, yes. You know, they were long days, you know, I mean, you couldn't get sick. You know, there's only a few of you there, and it was very much a liaison role. We played, apart from a personal security prime minister, it's very much a liaison role you play with the host government and the host security agencies, and I've talked about, you know, it's your personality that gets you through on those things. And it's understanding their, you know, the culture you're visiting, that you don't offend anybody. So they all went pretty smoothly. We just had some funny incidents from time to time. I mean we visited China in the 80s, and China in the 80s isn't obviously a completely different place to what China is now. I can remember we went to Chengdu, which is the capital of the Sichuan province, which is where the pandas are, and we went to visit the two pandas that were being sent over for the bicentenary. And we stayed in a guest house there in Chengdu, a government guest house, which was heavily fortified and bugged, I recall, because I went to take a walk one night and went the wrong way and was quickly hustled away from all the recording equipment that the Chinese people were going. But that was just, it was just a fascinating trip. One of Hawke's daughters with us was on that trip, and we didn't have anything on during the evening or later in the evening, and she came to me and she said, "Oh, you know, I want to go out for a walk." And I said, "Well, I think we were in Nanjing at the time." And she said, "I want to go out for a walk." And I said, "Well, you can't go out on your own." She said, "Well, will you come with me?" So I said, "Yeah, by all means." So we walked into town, into Nanjing. And what had happened is that the people had seen an aeroplane land and knew there was a VIP in town. And we walked into the main street, and we were approached by a young student who could speak English and said, "Are you," I suppose it weren't hard to pick out, "are you the, you know, did you come in on the plane?" And we said, "Yes." Anyway, the Hawke's daughter started a conversation, and literally within two or three minutes, we were surrounded by at least 200 people who were there because they were interested. And this one young student who could speak English was interpreting for the whole crowd. And in fact, they thought that the Prime Minister's daughter must be a princess, so they called her a princess. And that, but it was just, you know, I mean, it was just one of those spur of the moment things. But it just shows you what can happen in countries with huge populations. Bit like the Gandhi funeral, where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people can gather in minutes. I mean, we had a crowd of 200 totally surrounding us, all friendly, all just wanting, really interested. But you just never know in those situations. So yeah, it was. Yeah, we've had some interesting times.
You mentioned something about that the place you were staying was heavily bugged. What kind of protection did your team or your people that came with Hawke be able to protect him against that kind of?
We used to travel with a Somebody from Affairs used to travel on those overseas visits with us, who was a an expert.
Electronics
expert, yeah, to make sure that when there was meetings going on in his room that they weren't being.
So this was not something that would come under your...
It wasn't a police role at all, it was a foreign affairs role.
When you were walking, did like that, you left the Prime Minister by...
No, it wouldn't have been by himself, there was another two people with him. Because there would have been three of us. Plus he wasn't going anywhere, plus they were in a protected government. Yeah. Yes. It was either me or one of the others would have gone with it. Just happened to be me that she asked, so... And I felt like a walk as well. You often do at these. But yeah, just very, very interesting. Very interesting.
And all 23 of them, they kept you away from Canberra and from home for weeks on end.
Absolutely. Yeah, they did. Not only me. I mean, you know, it applies to all the staff. If you work with a Prime Minister, a lot of the Prime Minister's staff don't live in Canberra. A lot of politician staff come from wherever their home state is, their home electorate is. So people, when they work with politicians, spend a lot away from it. It's a big pressure on the family life, absolutely. And, you know, when you've got a young family growing up, you know, you miss big clumps of it. But, you know, that's the nature of the job, and there's lots and lots of people who have to do that, I'm afraid.
Moving on to something, well, back to something else. You mentioned that earlier in the first session, that the Prime Minister's protection staff, you actually had no office or any kind of home base in the Old Parliament House at all during your time here.
That's right, and that's... And when you see what everybody had to go with, it wasn't surprising, really. The area just inside the entrance to the suite, where there's a bench, often used to have to, and there was a telephone, a couple of telephones there, and it used to have to accommodate the attendants and the police. And that's where you were, that's where you made all your arrangements from. It wasn't ideal, but, you know, it was one of those things.
So where did the rest of your team, where did they...
If we were all in the house, we were all there.
Sitting in on that one small bed.
Well, it was either that or, people used to get up and move around. It was like a moving feast, you know. The ante room to the cabinet room, if the cabinet room wasn't being used, there's an ante room down there with the cabinet attendant, who was a real character in those days, a fellow called Osvaldo Meneghello. Very funny man. Often one of us used to go down and wander down there and sit down there in the comfortable seats and talk to Osvaldo while you were waiting. Also phones down there, so you could get to places, but obviously it wasn't ideal. And there was no, even when we moved to the new house, there had been an area designated for as a police office, which was immediately taken over by one of the staff. So there was slightly better accommodation there, and then they managed to get an office across, opposite the PM suite. But often in these things, in terms of accommodation and the security team often come last. Often because they're not there when the decisions are made.
How did you communicate with one another? In days before mobile phones, this was?
It's hard to remember, isn't it? We had radios. We all carried radios, and we had our own specific channel on those radios so we could talk to each other. But, you know, invariably we were together. But if somebody had to leave, and That's how you contact them, is by a radio, or if you were interstate, you used to ring the local AFP office, who would also get in touch with people. We had pagers as well. That's right. We used to carry pagers. there were pagers in those days, so we used to carry a pager. And I think the first time I was given a mobile phone was for an election campaign. And I'm not sure which one it was, but probably the 87 campaign, I would think. But then it was then that mobile phones were about the size and weight of two house bricks. And I was given one of these for the duration, and Hawke, the Prime Minister, didn't have one. He was quite interested in this phone I had. And I can recall, and because, Ben, I think I've mentioned before, one of Hawke's passions and his great relaxations was horse racing. And I can recall on the election campaign, we were in Perth, and we were going to do a function in Fremantle, which meant driving down in the morning. I think I was doing a function before lunch, and then driving back to the hotel at lunchtime for lunch. And so I got both the Prime Minister and Mrs. Hawke were going down, so they were sitting in the back of the car and I was sitting in the front, and I had this house brick of a thing on the floor in front of me, and we're travelling down there, and the Prime Minister said to me, "Oh, Roger, you got that phone, mate?" I said, "Yes, Prime Minister, do you want to use it?" He said, yeah, I want to use it. So I put it over the back seat, told him how to use it. So he got on the phone and I didn't take any notice of what he was doing. But sometime later, the phone came back over and I just took it from him, put it on the floor of the car. We went and did the function, drove all the way back into Perth to the hotel. It was lunchtime, so he was having lunch in his room. I was going down to the restaurant with my colleagues. Went to the security room, left our firearms, radios and this mobile phone in the security room. Went down for lunch, had lunch, came back up, got ready to go out again to another function in the afternoon. Picked up the mobile phone and I could hear something. Held it to my ear and it was the racing results. You know, Moonee Valley race 1, number 2, paid $3. So for the last 3 hours this phone... Because he hadn't remembered how to switch it off, so that was my, you know, that was my first dabble with mobile phones. Yeah.
Your workspace again. There's still a note on your name on one of the
yes.
Martindale.
Yeah, that's right.
What was that used for?
That was used for any sort of correspondence that came to you, whether it was delivered from the police, or you know. But from anywhere, it's just a correspondence locker. So we all had our names on there, and as I understand, when we left the office for the last time, then the place was left exactly as it was. It's a credit to Dynotape that's lasted that long, I think, although I notice there's Perspex over it now. So I guess it'll be there forever. Yeah.
And your name is next to two famous chauffeurs as well.
That's right, you know who those two are.
Indeed.
Gorgeous and what was it?
And Precious.
Precious and Gorgeous, yes. Noel Hansen and...
Who invented those names for them?
I think those two did between them. I think they were Commonwealth, you know, been Commonwealth drivers for many, 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 many years, both of them, and good friends. And I don't know, we may have named them Precious and Gorgeous, but I don't know. But certainly that's what they got on their correspondent boxes, was Precious and Gorgeous. Two good blokes. Two good fellas, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, the next thing I want to do a race with you is, you've mentioned a lot of stories about Bob Hawke. Any recollections about Malcolm Fraser? I mean, you know you only worked with him for a short period of time, but any sort of, what were your impressions of him?
As I said, I think initially I found him a fairly intimidating person, not only in his physical signs, but... he was a fairly blunt sort of man, I recall that first weekend I did. I talked about at his farm at Nareen, that it was the start of the duck shooting season, the first day of the duck shooting season, and I was down there with George Davidson, and George said he'd want to go duck shooting on his property first thing in the morning. So I said, what does that mean? He said, well, we'll get into this battered old ute and he'd be driving it, and you and I will be have white knuckles clenching the seats, and off we'll go with some guns. And I said, okay. And he said, are you all right with a shotgun? And I said, yeah, I'm fine with a shotgun. So he said, okay. So we had to go over to Fraser's residence. We were in the cottage next door at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I got this impression of Fraser and his wife Tammy standing in the kitchen eating marmalade and toast. And Fraser talking to George, but ignoring me because I was the new boy, totally ignoring me. Anything he wanted to know, he would do it through George. So I can remember him saying to George, can he shoot? And George said, yeah, of course he can. He said, will we give him a gun? And George said, yeah, we'll give him a gun. So so we did. So we went off, and George had said to me beforehand, when we get to where the ducks are, when we get to the lake where the ducks are, he said, find the biggest tree you can find and make sure you stand behind it, because he gets a bit excited. So we did. And I'm not a great sporting shooter. I'm not a sporting shooter. I don't particularly like shooting anything that's alive. So, but anyway, I did the right thing, and you know, got a couple of blasts. And things were, you know, guns were going off, and I'm not sure that everything was shot with a duck. I'm not quite sure. I think a few water hens came down that nobody could see. But anyway, but when we got back to the ute, George's advice was right, stand behind a tree, because there were pellets flying everywhere. Got back to the ute, and his windscreen was just peppered. And Fraser immediately said to George, he did that, pointing at me. Which, of course, I hadn't. But anyway, he was a very intimidating sort of fellow, especially for... I mean, now it wouldn't worry me. I've met Fraser on a few occasions since. And in fact, George died a couple of years ago, much too young in life, and here in Canberra. And Fraser came over for his funeral, which was to attend his funeral, which was very nice of him to do that. But so I assume they might have kept in touch, you know, for several years. And of course, you know, as you get more experienced. But when, you know, A, you're reasonably new to the country, and B, it's an area you've never worked in before, the leaders of the country can be quite intimidating. And he was pretty harsh on people. He could get angry very quickly. Tammy was marvellous, his wife. Tammy used to, you know, when he used to brush people up the wrong way, whoever they were, she used to go down and calm things afterwards and, you know, make it all well again. But I've met him a couple of times since, and I think he's mellowed quite a lot in his his old age. But huge pressure on Prime Minister, of course. And I don't think he used to. I mean, he wasn't a. I don't think he was terribly well. He didn't sleep well. He often used to ring people at 4 o'clock in the morning when he used to think of things, because he couldn't sleep. So it wasn't unusual for his chief of staff to get a call at 4 o'clock in the morning when, you know, from Fraser, who'd be at Nareen, and chief of staff was thought he was having a weekend off at home and fast asleep in bed when the phone would go in the middle of the night. And Fraser would have thought of something, and he just wouldn't think twice about getting somebody out of bed. So he was very, I think in the 7 years he was Prime Minister, he had seven chiefs of staff, or principal private secretaries, as they were called then. So they used to burn out pretty quickly. Yeah.
What about other Frasers or Hawke's ministers? Any that stand out in your memory? Yeah, I mean, did you have any direct dealings with them? I suppose that's
yeah, I did. Phil Lynch, when I first went to, when I first joined the Commonwealth Police in Melbourne, probably was the 75 campaign, I think, that Phil Lynch, the treasurer, who was the member for Frankston, and I happened to live at Frankston, was having a fairly hard time in his own electorate, so most of his stuff was being done in his own electorate. And also he was taken quite ill during that campaign and ended up in hospital. So I was assigned to him. That would have been the 75 campaign, which was fairly volatile, of course, being the dismissal election campaign. So that was, he was the first politician I got to know, and he was really nice. His family were very nice. Who else? Oh, Ian Sinclair was Ian Sinclair, the leader of the National Party. Talk about real characters, there was Sinclair and Doug Anthony there was another, the triumvirate of the National Party. They were really tough, really tough old-fashioned politicians that were about then. Hawke's ministers, I got to know them a lot better. Keating, of course, and of course towards the end he was Deputy Prime Minister, so he became Acting Prime Minister as well. So the team had to look after Keating when he didn't like that at all. He was not very happy with security until he became Prime Minister, and then he accepted it pretty well.
When you say wasn't very happy with, what did that actually interfere with it?
Apparently it did. You'd go to his house to, I didn't, because when he was acting Prime Minister, I was normally overseas with the Prime Minister, but the boys were left.